Name any business founder famous that experienced rapid success in the early 1900s. I bet you thought of Henry Ford first. Anybody else? How about Harvey Firestone? And I guess it only makes sense because his company was a supplier to Ford's growth. A few months ago, a book published by the great people behind the Farnham Street blog hit my radar. The book was originally published in 1926 by this famous business founder, Harvey Firestone. My expectations of the book, they were not high. But a few chapters in, I was wrong. Harvey Firestone is part Ben Franklin, part Peter Drucker, part Warren Buffett, part Alfred Sloan. Firestone's insights on money, planning, selling, deep thinking, taking time off, handling a crisis or two, except for the wording of his day, his message is timeless. The book is Men and Rubber by Harvey Firestone. Bruce Reed is the CFO of PracticeLink, and he's back to discuss this book with me for the next hour. I'm Mark Gandy, and this is CFO Bookshelf. Bruce, when I finish a book, the first question I usually ask, was this book worth reading? I thought it was. Did you like the book?
I love the book. When you first mentioned it, I thought, ho-hum, a book about tires and the running of a tire company. You know, we've heard this story before. I'll say, as usual, the books that you recommend, I think we've gotten to the point where you know what I do like and what I don't like. I trust you to recommend things that you think are going to bring me value. So I should have known there, but this was really a whole lot more than I expected and very enjoyable.
There is a origin story to the book. Harvey Firestone, the founder of the Firestone Rubber Company, Tire and Rubber Company. This book was published in 1926 originally, but this book has recently been republished. I don't know if I have the date right. It may have been 2023, but the people who published it is Lattice Work Publishing. And I have my date wrong. It's 2022. And the people behind Lattice Work Publishing, the founder of the Farnham Street blog, Shane Parrish. The book could be a little bit off-putting. It would be, if someone wrote the way Harvey Firestone did today, it's politically incorrect. I do want to read a line from the introduction so I won't feel guilty talking about this book with you, but Shane writes in the introduction, "When I give this book away as a gift, people are always surprised at the number of insights they extract from reading it. But here's the part where I want you to hear." He says, "We," so he has a team, "we have chosen to reprint the book with its original wording." Good for him. Let me do my own thinking. Let me think, yeah, I don't think he'd be saying that today. So the use of pronouns, the use of gender. Now, he never degrades women. Women are missing in the book. So it's man this, man that. So Shane chose to keep that. And yeah, we know how to process that today in this era. So
I think leaving it as it was is part of the lesson that we learn from it. So I'll say just because we live when we live. There was a bit of time when it was a little bit like the first couple times there was something that wouldn't be acceptable today. The way he said it, it was a little bit like, huh, but it's part of the story.
The other question I ask myself after I read a book, one of the first questions I ask was this worth reading? The other question I like to ask is, who is this book for? I enjoyed it, but who is this book for? Do you like business history?
I do. I think, and especially as I've matured and grown through career, I used to really want everything to be very technical. You know, I wanted to learn the nuts and bolts. But over time, you know, what I've come to discover is that it's the people and the stories and all of the different things, the human element and the human side of things that really make a difference. So I'm becoming more of a fan. I used to like the more technical books now, but I like adding business history into the mix.
The reason I ask is I think readers who like reading business history, this book is a treat. I don't spend my free time studying what the class schedules look like for MBA students. I think every MBA should be subjected to a class on business history, and a book like this would be a perfect book to read or go through, among other books that I would like to hand select. So I think the person who likes business history, I think the other reader is going to be the CEO who likes to read. When I think of business readers who read, A.G. Lafley is someone who comes to mind. He used to visit Drucker once a year. Jamie Dimon, I understand, is a big-time reader. I think CEOs who love reading, this is a Bill Gates-type book. You know, he's a reader. So again, who would read this book? I think students who love business history, CEOs who are very introspective and love reading. What were your impressions on Harvey Firestone, the pioneer, the entrepreneur, the chief executive?
Yeah, I think you had mentioned it somewhere along the line, and I've seen it said a couple times. He was a savvy business person, but it was more than that. He was, you know, almost like a philosopher. There, this, you know, the friends that he kept, you know, it wasn't, and I know we'll get into that later. So I don't want to move us along too quickly, but he surrounded himself with different types of people. And I think, and it just seemed to be because he gained pleasure and knowledge and energy from the different company.
I'm going to rattle off three names. Just tell me if you agree with the similarity or the comparison. Ben Franklin. When I say Firestone reminds me a little bit of Ben Franklin, do you agree or disagree with that?
I agree. I think Franklin, I didn't experience him as particularly quirky. He seemed like a pretty buttoned down, and, you know, and so Franklin had some quirks, but other than that, just kind of that curiosity. Everything wasn't, you know, one topic. It was, you know, the variety of topics, and, you know, and I guess even the, you know, his association with scientists and business people, and that's a lot like how I would envision a Ben Franklin.
I also compare him to Peter Drucker. Can you see that?
Oh yeah. Yeah, very management and leadership and executive leadership.
And then also Warren Buffett.
Of course. Of course. The conservative financial investments and conservative.
One more. I've got Alfred Sloan. So to me, he's an embodiment of these four. Can I read just a few quotes? The greatest pleasure is in doing something to help others, to help themselves. And finally, there's the supreme satisfaction of accomplishment. Here's a good one. Optimism and enthusiasm are valuable in keeping up the morale of an organization. They are lubricants which help to overcome friction. That line reminds me of psychological capital, which I don't think is talked enough. Let me read one more. Having a surplus is the greatest aid to business judgment that I know. He had some great one-liners on money, on finance, on economics, and that was my comparison to Ben Franklin. One more thing, Bruce, before we get into this. I do love reading books by CEO founders. On the website, I've got a post of about 20 to 25 entrepreneurs who have written books that I just think are, they should be classics in that genre. In terms of chief executive officers, Harvey Firestone, where does he rank? I just listed a few without doing any deep research. Alan Mulally, I think if Alan Mulally were to read this book, he'd be impressed. He would give us the thumbs up. Ken Iverson of Nucor is one of my favorite CEOs. Trader Joe Kloom. What a phenomenal, not only a great founder, but one of the, guy, an incredible executive, Bruce. Hunter Harrison is so incredibly, vastly underrated. By the way, Bill Gates knows exactly who Hunter Harrison was. I already said Alfred Sloan. Dick Stack is, that one came out of nowhere. He's the, technically, he's not the founder of Dick's Sporting Goods. His father was, but it was Dick that went from one store to like a gazillion out there. I'm exaggerating. So anyway, I just say Firestone ranks up there, in my opinion, some of the top CEOs. Throw in any business area you want, he's in the top. He's in the top 100 easily.
He seems very ahead of his time. I mean, given all of the leaders that you're mentioning, you know, by and large, they're, you know, more current, you know, more present day. And for somebody to be providing that kind of leadership in that type of industry at that time in our history is really pretty extraordinary.
I don't know this 100% for certain. I think Goodrich was the organization that I think monetized the pneumatic tires, or at least they brought them into the mainstream. But Firestone, I feel like probably was the organization that perfected the pneumatic tires. Well, they had to, because there was an order in 1905 between Ford and Firestone. And so those pneumatic tires, they had to be flawless. But I would just say that Firestone they didn't invent the pneumatic tires. That came a number of years before, but they pretty much perfected the technology. I think the dismountable rims, I'm not for sure if that came on Harvey's watch or not. Spare tires, I think, did come on his watch. I don't think this was in the book. The repair shops around the country was what a stroke of genius. Synthetic rubber. I want to bring up synthetic rubber again ahead of his time. He wanted so badly to come up with a replacement for rubber, and he never could. So it was about 20 years after he passed away, Firestone, they perfected a synthetic rubber that they started selling. And it's too bad he didn't get to live to see that. So when you say ahead of his time, bingo, absolutely. Hey, let's give listeners some perspective. I want to just briefly hit the timeline. So Harvey Firestone starts the business in 1900. They had $45,000 of capital. And they didn't start making tires for the tire industry until 1905, and then it really ramped up in 1906. So their first order with a car company, Ford, and that's how I got to know Henry Ford on a personal level. So again, that happened 05, 06. But they started the business in 1900, and they were making solid tires for carriage wheels. So that was essentially the business for the first 4.5 years. Started out with 10 employees. But by 1920 and beyond, 17,000 employees, 62 factory branch houses, 75 warehouses, 36,000 dealers, 100 foreign branches and distributors. By 1924, all debt was paid off. I even find this interesting. So in 1902, 2 years after the start, 12 people, $150,000 in sales. But 2 years later, Sales are up to 460, not quite half a million, 35 employees. And by 1905, 5 years after they start the business, Ford wanted 2,000 sets of tires, and they grew to 130 employees. So this company grew fast in a short period of time. You think it was a little bit stressful during that time period?
The saying, more people, more problems. I mean, that in and of itself is gonna add pressure to any type of a situation where you're growing in that. But then just the demand, and I think they were saying along the way, they simply didn't have the, you know, there wasn't enough material, there wasn't enough anything to meet the demand. And, you know, and that was starting to turn into, you know, that was starting to turn into a problem. That was starting to turn into a problem for him as well.
I want to read a line from the book. Do you like frameworks? Do you like frameworks?
Love a framework.
Well, listen to this. In the first year, we sold 110,000 worth of tires. In the second year, we sold 150,000. This was too much business for a company with 20,000 in cash. Listen to this line. I highlighted it. It's in red. It's in my journal. We were soon ahead of our capital. I'll read that again. We were soon ahead of our capital. What does that mean, Bruce? We were soon ahead of our capital.
Didn't have enough money up front to make the goods, to meet the demand, to then get paid. It was like being able to match the cash flow. Cash flows in and out, and the capital needed to make inventory.
I am not book smart, but I do think I'm street smart. So in my business, and I would say about 30 to 40% of the businesses I've worked with, I mean, they have been intense scale-ups, and a lot of it was accidental. Except for one company I can think of, no one said, I want to be this. Why haven't they just started their business and things just started growing? It's like nature took over. It's like, oh, I guess we need to meet this demand. And this is through observation, this framework I have, and maybe it's been inspired by other people, but I have what's called the 40-30-20-10 rule. Now, this is not a dorky, nerdy accounting exercise. In fact, I don't even want an accountant explaining this. It's a conversation, the 40-30-20-10 rule. So what do you do with your profits? Well, the first 40 goes to Uncle Sam. This is why you don't want an accountant discussing this because, yeah, maybe for some people, maybe 30%, maybe 32, but in my world, it's usually around 40%. The 30 is if you are growing fast, and this is just through observation, Bruce, I have observed that if you're retaining about 30% of the profits in the business, you can typically handle the growth internally, along with smart bank debt. So most big ramp-ups, unless you're in the tech space, SaaS space, most of the growth I see year over year over year, 20, 21, 25%. So if you're retaining 30%, you can handle it internally without bringing on any investors. 20% can go back to the owner, which means you're pulling out 60% overall. And the last 10%, you want to ask about the last 10%?
What do you do with the last 10%?
Goes to employees. And again, this is just through observation. About 25% of the businesses I've ever worked with, they'll do that. And even of that 25%, they end up struggling with it. Well, how we do it? We'll just do it. So we were soon ahead of our capital. I will just say this. They were growing far more than 30% a year at certain times because Ford was growing crazy. So how they were able to handle the growth to me is just nothing short of remarkable. So the timeline, the book was published in 26, but the heart of the story is from 1900 through about 1920. And in that 1920, they were well over 100 million in sales. I believe it was 115 million, and they had almost 20,000 employees. And for anyone who thinks that oh, it was easy. Well, you still had good, you had good Rich, you had Goodyear, you had Michelin, and then you had Dunlop. So Firestone was part of the big five in tires. So no, it wasn't easy. Yes, they had a good relationship with Ford, but they had to keep innovating and being pioneers in that space. One other quick observation, and I couldn't help but I read the Effective Executive every other year about, in fact, we are doing a show with a podcaster whom I really, really like. He's going to come on the show. We're going to be talking about the Effective Executive. So that's coming up in, I think, in May.
That sounds fun.
A little bit more than a month from now. And there were so many parts in that book that reminded me of Harvey Firestone's book, but the management of oneself, I just thought is incredible. He spent time alone just trying to figure things out. Mm-hmm. He was as much focused on managing himself than being a teacher, a coach, an enabler of other people. Did you pick up on that in the book, in your reading?
I did. It was, you know, again, it's, and I think it was, I would say it was one of those type of things that I think for, you know, particularly for a leader of industry or anybody at that time to be saying those things in that way, again, was what I thought was kind of groundbreaking there, and at least different than I was expecting, because it's, you know, you think of that time period and you think of very traditional, you know, almost military like type leaders, you know, stoic, you know, not getting over wrapped up in people's well-being. That's a time period where I don't perceive that as a time period where workers were valued. They were considered somewhat interchangeable, probably faceless. And he was really ahead of his time in that, and also in how he said, you know, that you've got to take care of yourself as well. And that's not the type of thing that I've, you know, I don't think that was necessarily the mindset of everybody. And even if it was the mindset, you weren't going to say it out loud. And he said things out loud in that book that I don't think everybody had the self-confidence and were as advanced to say those things in a book.
One of his comments with regard to the management of oneself, the only firm rule I have is to take up one thing at a time and to take up nothing else until my mind is free. Where have I heard that before? Where have you heard that before? I do not believe in, now this is going to be opinion. This is him. You can't just go out and be like Harvey Firestone, but I do not believe in quick decisions unless in an emergency. By the way, that is Alfred Sloan. That, in fact, they are interchangeable in that regard. I would rather take my time about making up my mind, and I nearly always manage to do so. This is Drucker. This is, name every famous management thinker, and this was written in 1926. So yes, I enjoy Firestone, the pioneer, the thinker, the executive, the person who takes people very, very, very seriously. We're going to get to that in just a minute.
Well, and on that topic of the one thing at a time, and why I think it's real important, and why I think that's a book that today's executive needs to keep in mind is, you know, what's all the rage now? Do more, grind, you know, you get multitask. You got to have the all these productivity tools because you got to be able to do 10 things at one time and this, that, and the other. And you know, research says, and he and Fires and Harvey Firestone was saying that in the book too, that you know, multitasking is a myth. And you know that, and the and task shifting is a drain on time, resource, and effectiveness. That you know, and in essence, that was what he was saying is, you know, don't, you know, focus in on what you're doing, be present. And that was I that was one of those, that was one of the parts of the book that again stuck out to me as well.
I want to hit four pillars in the book. We can't talk about everything in the book, but there are four pillars that stuck out to me. I liked the section on selling. And I don't talk a lot about my business, what I do in my space. In one of my clients, I am the co-CEO. And I love it. And so I'm getting to work very, very closely with the sales team. There are a couple other businesses I've been very involved with in helping to scale up their B2B sales organizations. And I love it. I just feel like I'm at home. So I was intrigued on some of the things that I read about sales. Can I read you a couple of quotes?
Yeah, go for it.
I guess you're not going to say no. No, you can't. sales, which is that you must thoroughly believe in what you have to sell. And then selling becomes merely a matter of showing how your product will help a prospect. I mean, that's a duh comment. But yeah, if you truly believe in what you are selling, selling is going to be very easy. Now, it's just a matter of this is how this product can help you. I have never attempted to sell anything which I did not thoroughly believe in. Therefore, I have never really had to sell because I believe in it. And one last thing, persuading, nice as a man, persuading a man, a person to buy is not, to my notion, salesmanship. It's just persuading him to buy and nothing more. So he doesn't do that. Here's what I want to ask you. I have never hired star salesmen, and I never will. I now agree with that based on what he just said earlier. What do you think of that? I will never hire star, and by the way, salespeople. We want to turn this into the 2023. I will never hire star salespeople, and I never will. Agree or push back?
No, I think it's a, I think the star salesperson is a sugar rush. You know, and my experiences have been, and it's kind of, you know, somewhat similar, but anybody who's on type a commission type of a business where you're having to convince another person to do something that they didn't necessarily wake up thinking they were going to do. And that can take a variety of forms, but I think it's the same. There's the same type of people that do it. And there's, you know, there's the hard sell. There's the enthusiastic sell. There's some that are stars just because they tiptoe the line between truth and fiction. And you can make some, you know, you can make some big short-term, you can make some short-term gains and you can make some short-term sales and bring in some good money with that star. There are times when that stars, the methods and everything else that comes with that stardom doesn't create a permanent bond with the customer. You know, a lot of times doesn't leave that customer anxious to continue to do business with that company because they don't necessarily feel like they came out as the winner and the beneficiary of the relationship. I don't think the star salesperson does not make the customer the ultimate beneficiary of the conversation, whereas what's being described, you know, here is, you know, in some ways the product is the star, and the salesperson is the facilitator. Shameless plug, I think that's Practice Link's sales and client relations team is top notch, and everybody loves them. Their customers love them. When they are out in the field, they get hugs. They get that. So there's definitely an appreciation there. But the Practice Link product is
the star.
Is the star. It's a damn good product that the clients gain a ton of benefit from. And so I feel like we're, you know, I feel like I'm living that experience right now. Shameless plug.
There is a trade-off. There's a trade-off when you have a star salesperson in the room. By the way, I do like star sales. It's more sales, but there is a it may not be a trade-off, but there's a concept in psychology that we learn called inattentional blindness. And if we're not careful, we don't think about some unintended consequences. What happens when that person leaves? Shane, in the introduction of this book that his publishing house republished, he says at the very beginning, Harvey Firestone's father was always planning ahead. He was always ready. Will you be ready when the star salesperson leaves for another position? That's the downside to star salespeople. They may leave. Good luck on that. Good luck on replacing them. It may take a year or two. I'm not saying they're bad. He saw this and he probably hired accordingly. So yeah, I love the comments on sales in this book. You brought up people. Here are five pillars that they had. Here are five pillars they had in the world of the way they treated people. Provide the best working conditions. Try to pay a somewhat higher wage than anyone else pays. Where'd that come from? It had to come from his upbringing, don't you think? They didn't have the Harvard Business Review back then. they provide rewards and facilities over and above what any other company provides. They insist that the foreman treat their, now I'm going to use the exact words in the book, insist that the foreman treat their men as human beings. So apparently were there no women on the assembly lines? And then five, avoid the strict definition of the duties of any supervisor or foreman in order that no man may easily pass the buck. This is a very people-centric organization.
Right. Isn't that crazy? A tire company in the early 1900s had their head screwed on straight on the people side of things. And it's, to me, that it's, again, like I'm repeating myself, but that was the extraordinary part of the book, is that a tire company, you know, and, you know, obviously it was a different time then, but, you know, I'm very familiar with that part of the country. With my wife's side of the family living in Canton, I'm very familiar. And it's an industrial part of the country.
Right.
And it's not Silicon Valley. It's not, you know, the financial district of there. It's, you know, it is industrial America. To see that was, they were very revolutionary as far as the treatment of people goes in that industry came a little bit unexpected.
When a new employee is hired, he is turned over to the doctors and dentists for examination. The idea being to give such employee advice as the best means of preserving his health. Where did that come from?
I was nervous as I was starting to read that. It's like, where is this heading? And it headed to a good place.
He just, there, they care, you know, about it was, people.
Well, and the way that sentence ends, I think, is the key, that it wasn't to check them out or to evaluate them.
Right.
It was to help them and to teach them to care for themselves. And, you know, that to me was like, that's what made that whole passage to me, was that it was, again, to educate and to build up the person.
I will also state for the 838th time, the people behind the Great Game of Business did not invent open book management or sharing of profits in 1917. And we have other examples that happened way before 1917, but Firestone started an employee stock savings plan, which any employee had the right to buy from 1 to 10 shares of common stock and pay for it through a deduction from their pay envelope at the rate of 75 cents a week a share. And at one point, for the people who had higher positions in the organization, officers, his goal was for the dividends to be able to take care of their living wages, even though they made good money back then. So again, sharing of profits through ownership, this was something that he believed in. It didn't happen early in the company. It didn't happen right away, 17 years after the starting of the business. I want to read one last comment. They did have a great suggestion system. There's like 5 or 6 bullet points. Readers will just have to read that. I love that suggestion system. But here's the Drucker type comment. In 1920, we did a business of $115 million. And I can say with great earnestness that financing this tremendous growth was not nearly as difficult as solving the human equation, or to be more accurate, getting something in the nature of a comprehension of the human equation. This guy sounds like an industrial psychologist.
Not what I come to expect from the industry or the time.
I do want to hit, there is some drama. Every good book needs drama. In 1920, the price of rubber dropped from 55 cents to 16 cents a pound. Now, we may think as a producer, that's a good thing. Hey, my raw materials have dropped. If I'm a consumer, that's a good thing. But what happens when you have lots of inventory at that older price, that older investment?
People will not buy it at the higher price.
That is right. And so it go ahead.
And, you know, I had to stop a couple times in that because it's that key element. It did occur to me that not every casual reader is going to put 2 and 2 together in that. I would assume that the average CFO bookshelf listener, you know, nods and moves on, but that, you know, that may not be that concept may not be obvious to everybody.
It's interesting because he's on vacation. He gets a wire. Sales have just stopped. I'm sure they're trickling through, but I mean, there was probably an abrupt decrease in sales. They had $43 million of indebtedness to banks. Banks would not lend them any more. So when sales stop, you still have all these fixed costs you have to meet. He comes back home. What's the first thing he does? Does he make quick, fast decisions? Is that the first thing he does, Bruce?
I think basically he said, everybody take the weekend off, get your rest. I'm going to go think about this, and we're going to hit this hard on Monday.
I went down to the old homestead to be alone and to what? Think. Mm-hmm. And by Saturday, I'd finish my what? Not a decision making, his thinking. So he comes back to the office. The dealers throughout America would not cut their prices because they didn't want to sell for a loss.
Right.
Well, the prices aren't going to come back. So here's what Firestone does. I'm going to make the first move. Harvey Firestone, first of all, he told his director of sales, you're no longer the director of sales for now. I'm going to wear that hat. Because you know why? We're going to cut prices 25%. He actually wanted to cut them more.
Right.
He knew he wouldn't be able to get away with it, but Salesforce said, no, you're crazy. Firestone, no, we're going to do this. And they did. I'll cut to the chase. A few months later, they owed no money to the bank. Remember, they owed $43 million later after that. So it took a lot of guts to do this. They were able to reduce the workforce some, even though profit was less than $1 million in 1921. By 1924, they were like, this is a business that Warren Buffett would probably want to own had he lived back then. But this is, to me, one of my favorite parts in the book. And yeah, so there's a little bit of drama. And even though we maybe have given away some things, there's still some other pieces in that section of the book that are just excellent, nothing short of excellent.
And that also kind of ties back to the quote that you mentioned earlier about having a surplus, his greatest aid to business judgment. Because of the conservatism that they had exhibited up to that point, they were able to, he wasn't shaken up by the whole thing.
No, he wasn't.
He was able to say, okay, not manic. My guess is he didn't sleep as well as he would on a normal night necessarily, but it doesn't sound like, at least by his telling, that anybody had their hair. He certainly didn't have his hair on fire.
I will have some of these quotes in the show notes, but the sections on planning, if you are an expert, if you are a professional in the world of FP&A, now in my business, we call it PRA, because I think FP&A is too narrow in its definition. I like PRA, planning, reporting, and analysis. But if you're an FP&A professional, this is an excellent book. There's some pillar information that you can just, it's foundational. He will say things like, the only danger in mapping the future lies in making plans inflexible. No one can know exactly what will happen next month, let alone next year. But reasonable plans can always be made, and they can be changed as circumstances require. A too rigid plan may be worse than no plan at all. That's why the best financial planners in the world were updating our plan regularly, whether it be monthly. I have some businesses I work with, we're updating the plan almost every week because we can't, the demand just, it's wonky. So good luck on just waiting monthly. So we make updates as needed. He has very strong opinions about budgets. He will say that the budget is the general guide, but nothing more than that. The budget, which actually controls us, covers us only 4 months ahead. So he's not talking out of two sides of his mouth. There's planning to get the bigger picture. Think of camels. We had a great conversation on camels. Camels is about capital adequacy, but budgeting is about liquidity and expense monitoring in the short term. So they did both. So the sections on planning and budgeting were, I thought, exceptional.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts, because it's, you work with some people who are just, I've worked in some organizations that were obsessed with the budget. A lot of time invested, and those are organizations that kind of would weaponize the budget a little bit. And that was, they were used to flog whoever was going to be the target of the quarter, and also used more for power, stealing budget and all those things. And so, again, it sounds like, what Harvey Firestone describes is a very mature and effective method of planning. And it really, it's, give yourself it. There needs to be some benchmark, landmark, North Star, whatever you want to call it, to kind of start from, or kind of know where you're deviating from, to tell the story of how the business is performing, financially and oftentimes operational. But the strict adherence to the budget is, I've never seen it particularly effective. A lot of people do it. It's easy and it's lazy. Planning, real planning, and you know, and real, and letting your behaviors be guided by what the numbers are telling you, that's harder. You know, it's harder to do, but it's a ton more effective. It's the, you know, the lazy person is the one that just like the budget.
What did you think of the section on the four vagabonds? Now, the four vagabonds is not used in the book, but do you remember the four vagabonds I'm describing?
Oh, yeah.
This came out of left field. It's like, I wasn't expecting this part in the book. You want to say what I'm explaining?
So Harvey Firestone, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and John Burroughs used to take, I guess it was, you know, unless the other stuff came up, would take these annual trips. You know, and it sounds like they called them camping trips. You know, I think there are elements of it that were camping trips, but it seems like there was also, you know, they would occasionally find opportunities to get out of the wild and back in and get cleaned back up was one of the segments of it. But it really was a very, you know, the book had a, you know, was very business centric, and then it was almost like just all of a sudden out of nowhere starts talking about these camping trips, and it was kind of just a sweet story of these four guys that really enjoyed each other company, respected each other tremendously, you know, and icons of, I mean, it really kind of, they kind of had the whole gambit. You had the industrial business side of things. You had science and you had nature. You know, with John Burroughs, the naturalist, as well. They were very different in their vocation, but all very similar in their view of life in some ways. When I read through the first time, it was kind of an odd detour from what I thought the book was about. And it's a very, that portion of the book is, there's a lot of the book invested in the adventures of the vagabonds. And they, you may be getting ready to hit on it, but you know, the four vagabonds, you know, added some star guests to their travels from time to time as well. And that was, you know, those parts were fascinating also.
I don't have the exact date. So again, we said that the company started in 1900. There's no way he could have started doing this in the first 5 years, let alone the first 10. I don't remember the exact date. I want to say it was around 1914. They did this for about 10 years. John Burroughs did pass away at 80, 81. So he did not make the last one or two trips. Firestone did not make the first trip either. It started out as Ford and Edison. They start out in Florida and did a trip together. And then that's when it's like, hey, let's invite a couple of our friends. So it expanded to primarily those four. And then it started becoming like the Woodstock of camping, because on one trip you had President Harding participating for a few days. I think Coolidge participated for a few days. But it got to be where there were just a ton of people that started following them. And one of the reasons they quit was because they weren't getting any more privacy. I've read others. Go ahead.
Well, they were saying the press used to show up.
The press used to show up. Yes.
Yeah.
And I would say that during the second half of the trips, two things that came out of those meetings. Well, not two things, but you think they talked about business? The answer is yeah. Not they both, but all four believed own your own business. They all believed. Now, I'd like to know what John Burroughs had to say, and then keep plenty of cash in the bank, make the banks work for you. So that's primarily the talks between Edison, Ford, and Firestone. I'm sure Burroughs is either sleeping or taking a nature walk during those conversations, but they all say that the moment that a company starts paying dividends without regard to future needs, it's as good as finished. High dividends may be a sign of strength, but more often they're a sign of heedless management. That's interesting. And again, those come out of those talks between especially those three. One thing I do in my practice, I do it very, very subtly. I don't just blurt out how much time do you take off. But when I meet a new business person and when I start working with that new business person, that owner, they're typically founder executives, I like to find out how much time off do they take. And there's two ways of taking off. You can just take off because you don't care about your business. But then there's the person who can take time off because he or she has a really good team behind them. And my big takeaway from all this is just getting away and knowing that you've got capable men and women running the organization. If you can't do this for weeks at a time, I mean, you're a slave to that business. And that's my big takeaway from this camping excursions. He never says that, but you pick up on it. It's like, oh, he was able to take time off from the business. You want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I don't think there's any better way to say that. It's, and again, it's, you know, you think of, you know, kind of some of the modern, you know, modern views, or at least kind of the, how different people think, or how, you know, or the way things are discussed. But that's, you know, the period that, you know, and you and I kind of probably, you know, we were probably at roughly the same points in our careers in the 80s, you know, and what was the, you know, the way you worked in the 80s was you were supposed to work 6-7 days a week. You know, your social life was your work life. There was no getting away. And that was rewarded and applauded. You know, and like I was saying earlier, you know, the, you know, over investing in productivity tools and multitasking and all of those different things. But at the end of the day, people are people. And if you grind too much, ultimately it's going to take a toll in solid judgment, behaviors, how you interact with people. And, you know, and in the end, if you're building this, you know, building the solid organization that can function, you know, for a few days or, you know, in their cases, a few weeks, you know, and I'd say at those senior roles, you know, the less. And I think he mentioned it earlier in the book too, that you really shouldn't have any duties as the CEO. Was it Edith said didn't even have a desk, I don't think. Yeah, to get to that point. That's just a very valuable lesson, I think. It's, you know, in some cases we're, you know, in some cases more realistic than others, you know, and you don't have to follow things by the letter of, you know, how Harvey Firestone did things. But I think it's a valuable lesson to take in some way, shape, or form.
Well, again, I thank you for doing this. I'm now got to figure out what book are we going to do next, because the books you and I have been talking about, when we do that, we do this about quarterly, our little two-person book club. It's like we're getting books that no one is really talking about. We did Around the Corner, Around the World, the Dunkin' Donuts story. The bar is high, Bruce.
Well, it's and I would have never come across this book on my own, and you know, it's always, I always appreciate the opportunity to branch out a little bit more and and read things and get to know, you know, different authors, different styles that I wouldn't come across just on my own.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
The four vagabonds, they did not just drive Fords. For instance, on one trip, their Lincoln got stuck in mud and a small boy watched as a horse pulled it out. And the boy went up to Henry Ford. He didn't know who he was. He just said, "You've got the wrong car. My dad drives a Ford. It never gets stuck." You want to know the best part of the story? Ford got the boy's name and had a brand new Ford sent to his father. Great, great, great story. As I mentioned earlier, I do like reading business history, and I'm betting you have read a book or two on Ford, Carnegie, and possibly Rockefeller. If you are looking for a few ideas, here are a few. Vanderbilt by Catherine Howe and Anderson Cooper. We've had Catherine on the show. My 40 Years with Ford by Charlie Sorensen. It's my favorite book on Ford. Freedom's Forge is outstanding. It's, in my opinion, a business classic. It's a book on how American business worked during World War II. We need to call this a wrap. A thank you to Bruce Reed. And let us both know on LinkedIn what you think of this book by Harvey Firestone after you read it. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.